Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Well, folks, thanks for joining the Sydney Institute's virtual discussions at a time of the pandemic. But as I've said before, it gives a great opportunity for those of our supporters outside of Sydney to attend our functions and see what's going on. And we're going to continue this when we get back to personal functions next year. And also this conversation is on the record and it will go up on YouTube and will be sent to our members who, for business reasons and personal reasons, can't be on a call at midday in the Australian Eastern States. So I'll start off, we're very grateful to Annalise Nilsson. We all know her well from her appearances on Sky News. Most recently, I think I saw you on the Bolt Report last night, I think it was. And we're very grateful. So I'll just introduce you very briefly because you're well known. Annalise Nilsson has a degree in law. She worked for a year in PwC in audit. She's been a reporter. She spent 1 year in China and then in Australia. She reported on television in Adelaide, Hobart and Ballarat. But of course, since 2016 for Sky News, where I wrote in my column in The Australian before the last election that I thought her reporting was the best coming out of the United States, because watching it nearly every night on Sky News, I had no idea what side Annalise Nilsson was on, which was very refreshing. She just reported it as she saw it, and she got out of Washington and went around the various states and gave us an idea of what was happening outside of DC and New York and the other major capitals. So we're very grateful to have you here today. And the topic is report from the USA. So away you go.
Yeah, look, thank you so much for having me. Firstly, it's always a privilege to talk to people about the stuff we work on every day. And one of the real joys of the last year has been seeing how engaged people have been with the US content. And it is so important to Australia and our future, and people want to know what's happening here. And one of the great privileges, again, of working for Sky is we get to speak to viewers who are very switched on, very clever, I would say. You always know that there's something more to what's happening than what we're being told by those in power. And one of the great joys we have is being able to analyze that, dissect that, and look at what's really happening. And there's been no shortage of things to talk about over the last year with what's been happening in the United States. I know over the last few weeks we did some pretty intensive coverage around the Virginia governor's election, and I felt like I spent half of the coverage just explaining why it was significant. And it's not because people don't grasp the importance of it, but it's because it seems a world away from what's happening in Australia, and there's plenty happening there as well. But this really was a significant race, and I think it's probably a good place to start to show the significance of how the tides are changing in the US, because we know voters here, those who live here, are notoriously fickle. They change their mind quite quickly. They tend to move on pretty quickly from things we might dwell on in Australia for a lot longer. And that seems to include the pandemic. The latest polling is very bad news for Joe Biden. He's not doing well, even compared to where Donald Trump was at the same time in his presidency, or Barack Obama. His approval ratings are worse, and he should have had a lot more wins now than he has had. But what's been really significant in that polling is that people are moving on from the pandemic, that the COVID response seems to have faded away from being front of mind issue for many people. It's either that they were never that concerned about the pandemic in the first place, and they were frustrated by the lockdowns, and they're glad that that's eased off. If they were concerned, they're vaccinated, getting boosters. Now with kids getting boosters, people are moving back from that. And it was quite telling in the Virginia governor's race that the Democrats ran on COVID response, and the other aspect they hit hard was Donald Trump and connecting Glenn Youngkin to Donald Trump's legacy. And the fact that didn't work speaks volumes about where America's heading. At the moment, there isn't extensive coverage of Donald Trump. We go to his rallies now, and I don't go to all of them. I pick the few ones I do. It tends to be the very niche media that follows him, or for the most part, it's foreign media like myself or wire services there in case something massive happens. And he's not on social media, so people have forgotten what that kind of continuous dripping of tweets from Donald Trump, not knowing when he was going to say something again, is like. And so he's not front of mind anymore. And the Democrats kept pushing that, and it simply hasn't worked. The other really telling thing from the Republican race in Virginia was focusing on schools. And that's been so important because that's a real factor in people's lives, that their kids haven't been in schools for a long period of time. So that becomes a flashpoint around masking, where you stand on that, on vaccinations, but also this underlying cultural war that's happening in the United States, where people feel like they need to take a stance on these things, that they're being judged for it, put into a box by people that they know or interact with. And it becomes a real issue about where you find your place in the world. And that's after a year of people feeling very isolated with, or 2 years almost, with the pandemic. So I think that's the underlying issue. We're starting to see it come out more with, there's been a lot of just anger issues in the US. There's been a real increase in assaults on airplanes, and a lot of that comes down to masking. There's been an increase in road rage reported. Crime is up across the country. People are frustrated, and that's pent up. So that's why this governor's race was so illuminating on so many different factors, because also those polls don't lie. We know that people, if you feel compelled to come out and vote about something, that's when you do cast your ballot. And right back to the beginning of covering it, I thought back to the coverage of the presidential race, where there were so many more Glenn Youngkin signs out than Terry McAuliffe signs. And I was driving through Virginia with a friend who happens to be Republican, and he was saying, look, I think we've got this because look at all these signs. And I said, look, from what I can tell, I think Glenn Youngkin's got it too, but I don't want to make the same mistake when everyone said, look, Trump's going to win the last election because look at all the signs out, signs don't vote. And I think that's very true, but signs are a very good indicator of how hard someone's working to win your vote. And so Glenn Youngkin obviously did that. Donald Trump's campaign worked harder, but the set of circumstances were that a lot of people just voted for Joe Biden on the basis that he wasn't Donald Trump. And so he didn't have to work as hard. He had to make himself a small target, and it worked. But that's not going to work into the future. It certainly doesn't seem to be exciting enough voters to keep them safe at midterms. And that's going to be the major factor for this presidency, whether he can get through enough legislation in the next year to really leave a lasting legacy. So that feels like a bit of a rant, but that's when you brought up about why the Virginia's governor elections mattered. It really did. It was a huge indicator of where this country sits.
Thanks very much for that. It's not a rant, it's just a brief summary with the emphasis on brief. So that's fine. So we're going to come to questions and discussion. As I said, this is on the record, and if you just indicate with your hand function, as indicated in the email that went out today, or wave to the camera if you're absolutely desperate, we will accommodate you. So just come, I'll start with a sort of a domestic question. As you would be aware, there's been a lot of coverage of our Prime Minister's visit to Rome and Glasgow, in particular in relation to the Australian-UK-US security arrangement. I mean, it's probably the best way to describe it, which is also has an aspect in it of the proposed nuclear submarine. Now, in relation to the argument between Australia and France, as it reflected on President Macron and President Biden, was there any much coverage of that in the United States, or doesn't the media care?
There's actually been a remarkable amount of coverage around it. The original announcement, it took a few days to filter through. I've noticed that the US news cycle, it doesn't burn through stories as quickly as we do in Australia. So things will tend to get picked up as a major issue the next day, especially in politics. and kind of cycle through for a few days. So the actual announcement itself, I probably didn't anticipate just how significant a news story it would be, especially as it came ahead of a Quad meeting. It became quite a significant story. But then the fallout with France, because it's come off the back of the coverage around the Afghanistan withdrawal, which is kind of universally acknowledged as being mishandled, chaotic. It's only the real diehard Democrats to say, look, this is what it was going to be like regardless. So that was just unavoidable. But you'll find a lot of moderate voters say, I agreed with getting out of Afghanistan, but it was handled poorly. So on the back of that, then the US has said, look, you know, we're the ones who are really good with dealing with, working with our allies. We're really good at consulting with them. And that was a really major issue that the Democrats campaigned on with Joe Biden. And so then to come off that and say, we're going to make this major security announcement, and then the French come out so furious. It was definitely a story, but then it really hit home when they withdrew the ambassador. And a lot of that is to do with the fact Secretary Antony Blinken from the State Department is quite a Francophile himself. He spent many years there. He speaks fluent French and he has quite a personal connection to France as well. And so there was that element where he was really quite personally aggrieved with how that all played out. And he was quick to go over to France to try and smooth the waters there. But they always had more leverage to continue the relationship than Australia did. It was quite telling when President Biden kind of dropped Australia in it and said it was handled clumsily, that he was under the impression it had been handled better. That is as much to do with keeping the French happy as saving face back home, because he's facing pretty tough time in the polls. He needs to be considered the statesman and the one who can work with allies. He was the one that was having to go to Glasgow without any strong climate commitment, despite coming in as president that was going to change America's relationship with climate. He rejoined the Paris Accord right away, and that's about all he's managed to achieve in that space in the meantime, because Congress, the numbers just aren't in his favour. But one of the side effects of that is Australia is in a very vulnerable position now, that we've signed up for this accord and they won't release the memorandum of understanding about what we've actually signed up for, and they're citing national security. That's pretty iffy about whether that's accurate. There is undoubtedly something they could release in the meantime, but they're choosing not to. And there's still this 18 months of negotiation. We don't have the French submarines. There's all this discussion now about leasing submarines in the meantime. And then the potential for there not even to be enough capacity in the United States for them to bring on construction of additional submarines online in a reasonable timeframe. They've said that that's not the case, that they can increase capacity, but that puts us in a very vulnerable position. But we're also quite disposable in all this. The Biden administration wasn't going to wear that with the French for us to save face. So Australia thinks that we can ride it out. We probably can, but in the meantime, they have put in a huge amount of effort to keeping the French happy. And a lot of that's to do with NATO. A lot of that's to do with keeping their own trade agreements going, because they have a lot to negotiate on that front. And it's going to be very difficult for Australia to find our footing again, because it was quite an abysmal trip for Scott Morrison. Not just that he... it wasn't just the policies, it wasn't just the interactions, it was the fact he didn't wear it in a statesmanlike way. That was the real charm of Donald Trump. He could go do whatever he wanted on an international stage and just kind of shrug it off. But we kind of looked like the kids with no friends to sit at lunch with. So that's a really hard thing to come back from on a world stage.
Describe to us the situation in the Biden administration, because as you know, this is an important agreement between the United States, Britain and Australia must have had significant support within the administration. Now, you mentioned that Blinken, the Secretary of State, is a Francophile. I think you can probably put John Kerry into that category as well. But there must have been people in at the Pentagon, in security, various security departments, in the White House, who obviously wanted saw this deal as an important deal vis-a-vis the United States and China and the Pacific, and generally the United States' involvement in the Pacific. So is what you're dealing with, and you've got a president who, being fair, is probably doesn't have the best memory and is not quite as on top of it as, say, he might have been 4 or 5 years ago. So is the administration divided on this, or is the Blinken view prevailing over what was probably the Kurt Campbell view in relation to the Pacific? I mean, how do you read the administration here?
Yeah, look, you hit on a few good points there. The first being China is the one thing everyone can agree on, and that's across the aisle. Everyone's scared of China, and the one thing that will get both sides of the aisle moving is saying this will counter their rise. It's notable the first piece of bipartisan legislation that passed through the Senate was about trade, with shutting out China from key production things. I think the main focus of it was solar panels, but it was quite significant in that it got that bipartisan support. It's still stuck in the House, but it looks set to be passed by the end of the year. When it comes to the administration, I mean, any objective observer can see that Joe Biden's not at the same kind of performance level that he was 5-10 years ago. People age, that happens. He was voted in, and there's not much you can do about it now. Everyone around him swears black and blue that he's just as sharp as ever, he's got this great memory, that there's nothing untoward. But I think any of us who watch him can see that it's just, I mean, you just get old, it happens. The idea that the administration is driving things for the president and not the other way around is something they rail against. Whenever it comes up as a suggestion, they will all say, no, that's Biden driving the show. And there is some evidence of that about with how the Afghanistan withdrawal was handled, with the decisions that were being made, that did seem like a top-down decision. And especially with the fallout after that, the on the record statements from the Pentagon, they were saying that it was the president's decision to withdraw in that way at that time and that they had to fall in line. So you can assume that that is true. When it comes to elements within the administration, there is a hugely powerful push about anything climate change related. And that comes from John Kerry being quite an influential figure in the administration, but then also across the board. That is a very popular core celeb at the moment, whether you agree with it or not. And what we've seen is that influence how they're interacting with the Indo-Pacific. You'll notice in legislation around the area, they insert climate change as much as they can. So it's something you cannot ignore, but there are some quite powerful people in the administration who've obviously got their eye on long-term political life as well, potentially running themselves for the top job. And Kamala Harris's polling isn't looking that fantastic either. So that does look like it is a wide open prospect at the moment for many of them. So they want to put their stamp on things like this. And those are very popular causes among the Democratic base.
Thanks. So, as I mentioned, you put your hand up or you wave to the camera. I've got you, Michael. So just remember, if you want to come in, that's the way to do it. And we've got plenty of time. Michael, boom.
Your comment about relations with France reminded me of the famous George S. General Patton's comment that he'd rather have a German division in front of him than a French one behind him. the question I wanted to ask was, what has been the political repercussions of the embarrassing failure of America in Glasgow to agree to end coal use by 2030?
Yeah, look, this was the really interesting thing with this whole push and putting Australia over a barrel about our climate change targets. And that's been a huge point of contention since the Biden administration came in. They weren't enthusiastic about dealing with Australia. They weren't enthusiastic about dealing with Scott Morrison's government, when he's the guy that was known for holding up a piece of coal in Parliament. Wherever you stand on the issue, we know where the Democrats stand on it, and we have known up until a pretty few interesting weeks, in the last few weeks, where Mr. Morrison stood on that as well. And so the idea that it's a popular issue is really hard to argue. A lot of those middle of the road voters, they're not that concerned with it, but they are concerned with electricity prices. So it hasn't had huge media coverage coming back from the conference. The speech from President Biden did in that he said that climate change was important, but then he came right back and it's all been about infrastructure. And that's about really bread and butter issues. That's about clean drinking water for people. I think it's $55 billion in there to new piping in, so there's not lead in the water. It's about fixing up roads. And then that becomes its own discussion around the social construct of different cities and how that influences different communities. So it's completely died off, I would say. And it's certainly nothing that anyone's brought up with me when I was out in Virginia talking to voters either.
Good Lord.
Okay, so if you want to come in, let me know. Okay, so you mentioned electricity prices. I had a recent view of one American US television station, I think, or what we call petrol, what the Americans call gas prices. There's been a very significant increase there, hasn't there? I mean, something like, could it be 30% since last November, since the election?
Yes, it depends where you live. It depends. There was a bit of a spike. You remember when there was that cyber attack on the oil pipeline along the East Coast that cut off fuel for a few days, and then it became quite scarce, and so prices have jumped around then. But I know personally with my car, it's gone from fueling up costing $30 to $50. DC is not very indicative of cost of living because there's so many other factors that go into living here. But across the country, it is going up, and it's up on last year and it's up on last month. And so that's something you can't argue with. But cost of living has gone up across the board. Groceries in particular, like red meat has become so expensive and hard to find. Like a lot of supermarkets, they all just have empty parts of the shelf where that's where you normally find it. Weird things hard to find with the supply chain issues. So going into a supermarket in Iowa, just no spices on the shelf because the spice delivery just hadn't arrived. And the problem is no one really knows what the problem is. That they know that the ships are all in the harbour and full and they're having trouble offloading them, and then there's not enough truck drivers, and they say, well, if we let truck drivers over the age of 18 instead of have to be 21 to drive, then that would help. But everything's just kind of so off kilter. Basically, the best economic minds have just been saying it's like a hose with too many kinks in it, where it's just every little thing's a bit wrong, and then they just can't seem to straighten it out. And we're coming up to a very retail intensive time in the US. We're coming up to Thanksgiving, which is pretty much the only holiday that everyone celebrates. Christmas, but even baking is normally a very popular thing this time of year. As the weather gets colder, you tend to go to family events and you'll bring something. It's hard to find some of those elements sometimes, sugar, butter. So these are all real issues, especially for a lot of people that have been out of work. There's no more unemployment benefits. Also housing has just been completely off the wall with people selling and buying, and that seems to be slowing down as well. So these are all real issues that are going to come to bite very soon.
So one of the real issues is the border. We know that the vice president concedes she hasn't been at the border, but then argued that she hadn't been to Europe at the time either. I think she's currently in Western Europe.
She's in France, actually, so we're waiting to see how that pans out for us.
France.
Yeah.
Okay. So how serious is the border question beyond those states close to the southern border? I mean, is it impacting on the middle of America and the north of America?
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting point, because when I was in Iowa recently doing some stories around the Trump rally there, I was interviewing quite a few people and saying, what's the biggest issue for you that you think the government should be addressing? And a lot of them were saying the border. And I just, I mean, we were thousands of miles away from the border, and I was just kind of stunned and saying, well, why? What, like, how does the border crisis affect you? And it does, it permeates right throughout the country, because many of the people who cross illegally then go through the rural areas to work in processing factories, on farms. And there was quite a high profile murder in Iowa, which was a person who was there illegally, murdered a young woman who was jogging. And drugs have really spiked, especially throughout the pandemic, but it's definitely trending up over the last 10 years. And they see that as a lot of trafficking coming over the border. So it does become a real issue for people living in that part of the world, especially when they have the kind of lifestyle that they like. They have the same kind of community that they've always grown up with. They're not big on change at the best of times. And then when you have large groups of people like that coming through, it kind of sets them off, and then bad things happen and it gets worse. And so it is a real issue across the country, but across the border, it's a genuine crisis. And we spent some time reporting there. I got to go down with a crew to the southern border of Texas and then over into Mexico. And it is just a free-for-all. I was, when we were going down there, I was calling Border Force, and I was really stressed about trying to find people actually crossing illegally. And I was saying, where do I go? What do I do? And they were like, they can't really help you because they're government agencies. But the guy was like, look, don't worry. Like, you're going to see it. And we got to Del Rio, and the first night we were there, we were driving out to just film the actual border wall. And just a couple of people ran across the road and then straight up to police. They want to hand themselves in. They want to get processed and claim asylum. And it was just nonstop after that. It was just unbelievable. It was just every time you drove up and down the road, someone would come out of the field. And we were interviewing people who lived there, and they would say, like, oh, yeah, every night people come through our backyard. And they were showing us their home security cameras, and it was just hordes of them. And many of them had lived there for a long time and said, this is, we've never seen it like this before. We've always had people cross over, but we've never seen it like this. You talk to the migrants coming over, and they would say, oh, Joe Biden's in, and he said that we're not going to get separated from our families. And it was just that small change in policy, when just the change in rhetoric and just that tiny change in policy that just incentivized so many people to come over. And then they just get released down into the populace. But the other question of what the significance of it was, a lot of these people were coming over with COVID. And so it became a real bargaining point for conservatives arguing with Democrats, who are saying you can't have major events, you can't have schools open. And they would say, well, why aren't you policing people coming over the border? And they weren't necessarily that concerned about COVID in the first place, but they would, the comparison was just too easy to make, to say, how can you possibly care about the COVID pandemic if you're just letting people come in like this? And a lot of the testing being done of these migrants wasn't the government doing it either. It was not for profits. So it was just this kind of perfect storm of issues all happening at the same time. And then Kamala Harris saying, I don't need to go down there. Why do I need to go down there? Why would the president need to go down there? It just added fuel to the fire. And personally, having been there, I think you do really need to go down there and see what it's like and see what these border communities are dealing with. Because a lot of the people living along the border were immigrants that came over legally for farm visas and things like that. There is a real solution to actually be recruiting people to work on these farms, because they're having trouble finding labor. They really should be doing that to undercut the illegal trade, but you're not going to see that if you don't go there and look at it yourself.
Okay, thanks. So we go to Anne, and then we go to Ida. Anne?
Just following up on that border discussion, what's the story behind the proposed $450,000 per person for those who were illegal and whatever, we would call it put in detention, the Americans locked up? I mean, it seems incredible. If that happened in Australia, it would be the end of any government. How's that going over?
Yeah, it's one of those ones where you do a bit of a double take at the headline and you go, that can't be right. And then you look at it and you go, oh, wow, that's actually what they're talking about. So, yeah, as you said, they're looking at so this isn't from the administration directly. It's from the Department of Justice looking at compensation for those who came over the border, were put into detention and separated from underage relatives. And so the argument from the Department of Justice is that they breached international law, and so they have to try and provide them compensation for that. Now, the thing with that is, if they weren't actively looking to do this, there's no real mechanism for these people to do it themselves. This problem probably would just kind of disappear and go away. It's them trying to actively prosecute what they saw as a failing of the Trump administration. But it's just turned into a bit of an own goal, because that's an extraordinary figure. And that is 450,000 is the maximum that they were looking at. It's become blown up because in one of the few press conferences we've seen with the president of late, the Fox News reporter said, how do you feel about that? And the president said it was a garbage report. And then they had to walk that back because it wasn't garbage. It was quite factual. And now they're looking at trying to find a much smaller figure to do that compensation. But they're not walking away from the idea that they should be compensating these people. And that, again, sends a pretty horrific message when you're trying to stop people walking over the border.
Ida.
Thank you so much for your information and insights. What is your view of the mainline media in the US and their apparent general political partisanship of the Democratic Party?
Well, so the media here is very different from what you see in Australia, and I found it quite confronting when I first got here, because I think especially in Australia, you're kind of constantly fed this idea that Fox News is so partisan, and then you get to the US and you realize, I mean, Fox News does a fantastic job, love working there, but CNN, I mean, does the exact same and then some with their own kind of opinion programming and kind of editorial focus, you could say. And I found it quite unsettling at first. I didn't quite like how everything was so put, but the longer I've been here, the more I do like it, because you know exactly where everyone's coming from. No one's kind of putting forward this idea that they're not of a certain opinion. They're just telling you, this is what my opinion is, and then they're backing it up. And I actually quite like that. I think it's more like a system where you have a bit of a good debate and you let the opinion guys be the opinion guys and you let the news guys be the news guys. And I think that's kind of more what we do at Sky. Like, we don't hide that our opinion hosts have an opinion, we let them do it and we have a good debate and we hopefully make interesting television. I think we do, but I think it does get characterized a bit, and there's actually a lot to it, but there is a definite liberal slant to a lot of it, and it's noticeable in the amount of goodwill towards the current administration and some things that happened. If the exact same thing had happened with Donald Trump, it would have been just the end of the world, endless coverage, and the equivalent here will just kind of get a bit of a mention. Everyone moves on, especially the gaffes from President Biden, which are not insignificant in number. So I think that's a good point to raise. It's a very different environment here compared to Australia.
Yes.
Thanks for the presentation. Leading on from Ida's question, what's your take on the independent content creators, the really big ones, Crowder, Joe Rogan, Tim Pool, and some of the other independent news networks as you're growing up there, like Newsmax? Not familiar with OANN, but certainly Newsmax I am very familiar with.
Look, I think it's always really good to have a lot of competition. I think it's good to have a lot of diversity in media. The good players will be able to compete. I think that's why it's good we have privately owned news companies like News Corp. I think we do above and beyond. I have to say, I don't follow many of them closely personally. I do meet a lot of their people on the road and they're all quite nice. It's yeah, I can't say I'm too familiar with all their content, but, you know, always up for a bit of healthy competition.
Well, certainly Tucker Carlson and Hannity are very popular here, and Laura Ingraham. I mean, I know this is quite a busy session, but there are a lot of people who just don't watch Australian television. They watch Hannity, Tucker. Most of my friends do that. Yeah, they just don't watch Sky. They watch Fox USA.
Well, tell them to watch Sky.
I'll let it keep it going. Yeah, well,
most of my friends watch Sky. And we watch Fox on the side.
Yeah. Fox is fantastic.
Now, in your reports from the United States, particularly Virginia, you mentioned this debate about critical race theory, which where we would use a different term in Australia probably, but tell us how that became such a fairly sudden issue in that it affected a wide part of the electorate, whereas normally these kind of matters are debates you might hear on Sky or Fox or on the ABC, but they're probably not the sort of main thing that takes a role in the election campaign. So how did it come to pass that critical race theory became so important, and even that people could remember the term critical race theory, because it's not a normal term that's been around for long?
Yeah, no, and it's kind of counterintuitive about, but like, it sounds like you're being critical of race, but yeah, it's awfully complicated. I've done a few interviews about it. I'm kind of working on a longer term piece, but it all comes back to schools. This is, again, why it's taken off, because people will kind of deal with stuff in a workplace. You'll walk past a relative or something, but when you have to sit there and be told that your child is going to be taught something as fact, that's when people will reach their last tether. And it all really can be traced back to the murder of George Floyd. When that happened, it sparked this national conversation around race, not least because of the rioting that came with it, and it just dominated people's lives for a month. But for a lot of people, their response to that was, we need to reframe how we talk about race in America. And I mean, there's certainly fertile ground to talk about that issue in the US. There are a lot of issues around race in America, but the response was, we have to teach this in schools. And then it's become the politicization of things that aren't normally politicized curriculum. People want to work it into how you teach math, and math as being a socialist, communist, constructural. I'm not even joking. It becomes an actual discussion around whether it's an imperialist idea that we're teaching, that there's only one way to do math. And I don't know, I sucked at math, but I could accept that. But the discussion has engulfed school boards, and this is where people at a really grassroots level, and especially Republicans, have been really strong with petitioning their local school boards about it and then trying to get their own people on those school boards. And that's where they do really well in elections, because they keep doing this stuff all the time. And then so when it comes to a presidential election, they're organized, they know which people they're talking to because they've been dealing with them on the local school board, they deal with them when they're looking at voting for the local mayor, and it works its way up. And Democrats tend to kind of do this broad stroke where they get this one person at the top who they want to be really inspiring, and then have this trickle down effect. But we've seen school board meetings completely get out of control. There's been a mass walkout of states adhering to the school board association across the country. And so then that's become really fractured. And there's a lot of parents who were already considering pulling their kids out of public school over the last year because they were doing at-home learning, or they were having to wear masks, or required to get a vaccine is the discussion now. And a lot of people have been pulling their kids out to either do just straight homeschooling or put them in private schools and a lot of Catholic schools. And they've managed to, on the whole, keep their schools open. So sorry, that's a bit of a tangent, but the idea of critical race theory has just become fundamental for so many people, just drawing that line saying, I just can't adhere to teaching this to my child, and that's why it's become such a national problem.
Before we go to Anne, tell us how local school boards get chosen or elected, or how do they, because we don't really have that equivalent here.
Elected, yeah. So people run for local school boards, and they'll put sandwich boards out on the street to vote for your local superintendent, to vote for those positions, and they're hard-fought races a lot of the time. They get quite nasty, some of these elections. People take them very seriously.
Go to Anne, then we go to Mark. Anne?
It's fascinating how engaged some Americans are in their political system, much more than us. So tell me, how's Joe Brandon going? Is he likely to get the Republican nomination? I'm joking about that, but you might explain what's happening.
Yeah, the Let's Go Brandon. Oh, my gosh, because the first time I saw that was at the Trump rally in Iowa. Someone had rented a big banner and the whole crowd was cheering. And I had to Google it. I was like, what is this Let's Go Brandon thing? So it does speak to, especially that kind of that community, the distrust in mainstream media. It was a NASCAR journalist interviewing this driver, Brandon, after he won a race, and he must have done really well or something. But as she was interviewing him, the crowd started chanting F Joe Biden. Censoring myself a little here. And then she heard that as Let's Go Brandon. And so she said to the driver, oh, the crowd's really excited. They're saying, let's go, Brandon. And then it just went viral. And a lot of that was them set the kind of crowd that hates Joe Biden saying, this is what the mainstream media does. They twist things to suit themselves. Having been in that situation, reporting in a very loud environment, I absolutely give her the benefit of the doubt that she thought that they were, especially in that content, Brandon, but it's become an absolute catch cry. And it's also politically correct. There were a lot of F Joe Biden signs that don't get a lot of coverage because it's too rude to put on TV. It's too rude to post on a mainstream social media account. But she's unwittingly created a new rally cry.
Mark.
Annalise, thanks very much for your time and for your views. You touched on Kamala Harris earlier. She appears to be in a death spiral. Is that your assessment from there, or is it just the way it's being reported here?
It's a really interesting one. So I first started covering the perception of Kamala Harris during the election campaign, and it was when I was interviewing especially any people of color, any Black Americans, I would say, what do you think of Kamala Harris potentially being vice president? And I was genuinely shocked how many of them were really turned off by Kamala Harris. And you get a lot of the, especially when they're on camera, they'd always say, I don't really know about her. And I was always like, what? How do you not know about her? Like, she's going to be the vice president, apparently. And then you get them off camera and they'd say, yeah, just don't like her. Just really don't like her. And then you kind of tease it out. And a lot of it came back to when she was a prosecutor. And she took this really hardline stance trying to actually incarcerate the parents of kids who were truant too often, because she was like, it's criminal if you're not taking your kids to school. And there are just so many issues of inequality that would stop a parent getting their kids to school every day that you would think that the Democrats would be super sensitive to. And it just turned off so many people on her side. And there's just been nothing to help recover that image in the meantime. She's done incredibly well being the first female vice president. That's nothing you can ever take away from her. And that's the highest office any woman's reached in America. But the issue is just how you translate that to people wanting to trust her as commander in chief. And she completely disappeared during the Afghanistan withdrawal. And the reporting was that she didn't want any of that attached to her. I think it was a Politico report that said she was heard saying, I don't want them to stick that shit on me. The border staff has been a bit of a disaster. She should have just gone down there early, done a quick like peace, whatever, get in, get out, and then say you've done it. But she dragged it out, and then that awful comment about, well, I haven't been to Europe either. And it's like, well, there's no migrant crisis in Europe from to America, so great. And she just hasn't had a big win. She's been doing this space stuff. That's not a huge winner, but it seems like they're playing a really long game. They just want to keep her out of all the bad publicity of the first year as the honeymoon period fades away, and they want to bring her back with a vengeance when it comes time to primaries. But she's got a lot of competition. There's a lot of people who know there's no way that we're going to see Joe Biden run again. He says he's going to run again, and it seems like that's just to keep the conversation around who's next. But you just can't see him doing it. It just makes no sense.
Yeah, Nick, are you ready, Nick?
I was just wondering, it seems like the conventional wisdom is now that the Democrats are in a lot of trouble at the midterm elections. So what, if anything, are they actually going to try and pass through Congress before that?
Well, this is the really funny thing. So they are in trouble. Objectively, they're in trouble. If they get the same kind of result that they got in Virginia, they're going to lose control of the of Congress. Their response has been completely split down the moderates and the progressives. And so they finally passed this infrastructure legislation, which was passed with support of Republicans in the Senate. But now they're arguing about what's going to happen if they don't pass all these progressive measures in the reconciliation process. And that's for really bold things that a lot of Americans are going to be put off about. We've already seen them be put off about things like universal pre-K, paid leave, some of the more extreme climate elements, free community college across the country. That's all still in there. And it's still a complete mess about what's in and out. But the progressives in the party is saying, if we don't get all these really bold policies through, we're not going to inspire people enough to vote in the midterms, which seems to take for granted all the moderate Democrats who voted for Joe Biden just because he wasn't Donald Trump. And I think that they're still operating on this idea that people really liked Joe Biden. And a lot of people really do like Joe Biden, but he didn't get that record number because that many people loved him. He got that record number because that many people were just so fed up with Donald Trump and got out to vote who don't normally vote. And they probably can't count on that at the midterm. So things are looking very good, but a lot can change in a year. So it would be foolhardy for the Republicans to take any of that for granted.
Michael?
You've reasonably dismissed the vice president as a potential candidate at the next election, and Biden will presumably be incapable of running. Who are the left's potentials within the Democrats and the not-so-left's potentials in the Democrats to be candidates?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. I'd say we're going to get some left-of-center prospects coming out in the next Democratic primaries, because I think there were so many options already smoked out in the last primaries that didn't make it over the line when they thought they had such a strong base going against Trump. There was this assumption in the Democrats that it didn't matter who they ran, they would win, but then they got spooked and went back to like the safest option possible. I think this time they're going to be so emboldened by being in power for so long, they're probably going to push for someone unusual. I know it sounds crazy. I wouldn't rule out John Kerry having another crack. Kamala Harris isn't going to go down quietly. I think she's going to definitely try to dominate the field again. Any chance Pete Buttigieg could try again? I would say... It's really hard to kind of pick this because so much of the discussion has been around the Republicans too. But I would also, I'd say that they're going to have a strong push to have a woman in there. And that will be probably the one that takes out Kamala in the process. And then they end up with someone else. But who that woman is,
Will it depend on whether Trump runs again?
Yeah, I don't think Trump will run again, is my sense at the moment. I know he wants to run again, and he's definitely, it seems, in place to announce that he's going to run again. A lot of that comes down to that's how he keeps his funding for his PAC going. And so one of the reasons he wouldn't have announced it at this point too is then that impacts the reporting requirements for the money he collects. And so after he does that, that's going to be a separate conversation. My suspicion is that the Republicans are going to be a little more organized this time about having their own person in place. They don't want to get caught off guard again. And they've just been given this perfect blueprint by Youngkin about how to run a campaign, embracing the Trump legacy, but not requiring it. Basically since the election, every Republican I've talked to has said they'll vote for Trump again if they have to. A lot of them still like him, but it's not do or die. They'll definitely vote for someone else. And they throw out a lot of names. I know DeSantis has been thrown out quite a bit, but I don't know if he would potentially make it. There's a lot of appetite for a woman. Nikki Haley and Kristi Noem are names that come up very often for the Republicans. But we've seen Pompeo doing a lot of work around Iowa already. A lot of former Trump ones. I think Pence is out. I'd be really surprised if he could turn that around, because the Trump base, while they would support someone else, they hate Pence for January 6th. So I'm not saying it couldn't happen, but it would be... it would have to take some serious rebranding. And how would the other Republican names get thrown around? I don't know. I was the one to watch. I want to spend a bit more time around Iowa. I'm hoping workloads may go there for that, because that's where they all kind of flex their muscles, and there's been a lot of them doing that.
It's Jess.
Thank you, Jared. Look, you did answer most of my question. It was about how the Republican Party are managing Trump leading up to the next nomination. That said, maybe you could take us back to the climate change issue a little bit. And what would you say that the Republicans' position is on climate change, given that they're in opposition, they don't have to talk about it too much? Are they flatly opposed to the Democrats' position and where Biden's taking them, or do they have a more nuanced position?
Yeah, they really don't care that much. Like, it just doesn't come up compared to the Democrats, just so evangelical about it. I think there's the appetite for doing things to improve the environment. There's a lot of let me say it like this. There's a lot of people within the Republicans who do believe climate change is real, and they do think that we should do more to fix it, but they're very attuned to the idea that it shouldn't be at a cost, and it shouldn't come at a cost of living issue for everyday voters. And that's when they get really worked up if it's something that's going to increase the price of electricity or come across as something like a carbon tax that they're completely allergic to. But it's just not even one of the top 10 issues that they talk to voters about.
Thanks.
Finally, tell us a bit about yourself. I think you went to the US in... was it sort of towards the middle of 2020?
I went in January as well to cover the Iowa caucuses. And then I went back, August, to cover the election, and just never left.
Still there now. You seem to do a lot of work. I'm not sure how many people the ABC have in Washington, D.C. I think it's about half a dozen. I'm talking about television reporters and radio reporters. I'm not talking about production staff and camera crew or whatever. I think it must be over half a dozen. You seem to do a lot by yourself over there.
Thank you. If you could tell the bosses that, that'd be great. I think they've got three on-air people. And then I think one of them does radio as well. And they have two cameramen and three producers.
Then they've got Sarah Ferguson and Tony Jones as roving reporters.
I think they might have left. I'm actually not 100% sure on that.
I haven't seen them around here yet.
Yeah, they're not here.
I don't think so. Well, they may have. I don't know. So your term there is what? Or you don't know?
Hopefully just indefinitely. It's at least 3 years. Yeah, I'd hope I don't do all this work and then get pulled back before the election, but you never know.
Just your background is Australian-American?
Yes, so Dad's American. He was born and raised in Chicago. And so we still have a lot of family here. My sister lives here, so come back. We used to come back every year. But yeah, that's one of the reasons they sent me over is I have the great joy of being a dual citizen, which is fun until you have to start filing your taxes. But it's been a huge godsend over the last year to help keep me here.
So we're going to finish with Anne, but just before we do, so you lived in the United States before your current posting for a long time, or you don't have much of any American accent?
No, I only ever used to come here for a few weeks at a time. I spent 3 months here in LA after I graduated uni, but that was just kind of doing bits and pieces. Yeah.
And finally.
I just wondered if Annalise has any suggestions for what are the states or the seats or the areas to watch for the midterms? Where might you see change?
Yeah, well, this is really interesting now, isn't it? Because Virginia's just kind of changed everything. Now, all of a sudden, CNN was running graphics saying, we better watch Georgia, we better watch Arizona. And it's like, yeah, you better. New Hampshire's the other one that we're going to be keeping an eye on. Otherwise, Pennsylvania, I mean, we all have to watch now after what happened with the election count. Hopefully, sorted some of those issues out. But the South isn't as much of a given as it used to be. Florida is going to be another one to watch because in this time, I mean, they've just basically lived as if the pandemic wasn't happening. I think they shut down for like a month in the beginning and they've done quite well. They haven't had as bad of experiences everyone made out that they were going to have without those restrictions. And so in that time, they weathered the pandemic well. And if anything, they're increasing the number of Hispanic immigrants that tend to vote Republican now. So that's going to be one to watch. But yeah, otherwise, I would say New Hampshire and Virginia. Now that's a swing state again. So,
Annalise, you've done a great job. Those of us on this call will know, and also will go up on YouTube. We send it out to our members. And of course, you're one of the reasons why so many of us watch Sky News every night to get an update on what's been going on in the United States the previous day. So we're very grateful for your performance today. We hope we'll do it sometime in the future. But today, many thanks, and that was great.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.